Welcome to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Conversations that are real, raw, and relevant. Let's get the conversation started now.
Hey, welcome to episode number 14 of Necessary Conversations. Today I'm joined by Dr. John R. Faison Sr. He's the senior pastor of the Watson Grove Baptist Church of Nashville, Tennessee. On today's episode, we're going to discuss the trauma associated with the African-American experience. Let's get to it right now. You know, since the 17th and 18th centuries, African-Americans have experienced a disproportionate amount of trauma, from being kidnapped from the continent of Africa to being bought and sold like cattle, forced into slavery in American colonies and exploited and therefore lorded over as they worked in tobacco and cotton fields. Although the Emancipation Proclamation was passed in 1863, declaring an end of slavery, it took an additional 2 years for slaves in the Lower South to receive this message. Although on June 19, 1865, an army ship arrived announcing freedom to those in the southern regions, African Americans would still go on to experience a heightened level of trauma. On December 24, 1865, the Ku Klux Klan, a white supremacist hate group, was established, therefore giving way to the lynching of black folks. Even in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, African Americans fought tirelessly for freedom and equality, from being beaten at lunch counters to being bit by savage dogs, even having high-pressure water hoses turned on them. African Americans have experienced trauma. Let's fast forward to present day. Even in the year 2020, as we look on the news and we scroll on social media, we see African Americans still fighting for freedom and equality that was said to be ours in 1863. From the ever-present stain of racism in our communities to the thrusting of police brutality on the main stage, even the disproportionate amount of racial profiling that happens within our communities of color, African Americans still experience trauma. Dr. Faison, you've experienced this trauma in a very personal way, having been a victim of racial profiling, even in Nashville. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was my first trip to Nashville ever.
Wow.
My first time in Nashville. I was actually in the Baptist flow. We candidate for churches. So
yeah, yeah,
I was a candidate at Watson Grove for the church that I now pastor. And it was my first visit. So I'm here to interview and do all that kind of stuff. And after the interview, just kind of was on my way back to the hotel and got pulled over. Now I was driving an electric blue Ford Mustang, right?
Wow, yeah.
Electric blue Ford Mustang, because it was the only car that the rental car agency had. You black men, we know how this works, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You go rent a car, you want something nondescript, something
right.
simple.
Yeah.
And they gave me an electric blue Ford Mustang.
Oh yeah, they wanted you to be obvious.
So man, listen, I get, you know, it didn't take long at all. I'm on my way back to the hotel and I see the lights, I get pulled, and something crazy, man. They come up and they ask me for a license and registration. And I said, okay, no problem. Why did you pull me off?
Right.
He said, you threw a cigarette butt out of the window.
Crazy.
First of all, man, I'm a health nut. I don't smoke.
That's
not my thing. Never done it in my life.
Yeah.
So clearly you're reaching, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay. I've seen this before.
Right.
I'm from Virginia. I've been in multiple states. I've been pulled over before. I know how this works.
Right.
I'm clearly being profiled. I either fit a description or they are expecting me to lead them somewhere or they expect to get a chance to search my car and find something.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, no problem. We'll go through it. We've been through it before. You know, I do the same thing that I teach my kids. Hand it a 10 and a 2 on the wheel. Ask them, listen, I need to reach for my registration. Is that okay?
Right.
And reach slowly. Grab the registration and give it to them. Go through the whole thing. Man, ultimately, they end up letting me go. But before they let me go, they asked me, can I search your car? And I told them, no, you can't search my car. You have no probable cause. You have no reason to search my car.
Yeah.
And from that, they let me go. Now, if I don't know my rights, I get put in a situation where they search my car and they wouldn't find anything, but it's the idea that you've infringed upon me and you're trying to utilize this moment to feed some kind of assumptions that you naturally have.
Right.
And that was my introduction to Nashville.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's like, welcome to Nashville, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what
And here's the deal. You knew your rights.
Yeah.
Imagine the African-American men that drive around the streets of Nashville, Virginia, Texas, Florida, all day long and are pulled over and are now in jail because they didn't know their rights.
Yeah.
And some of them didn't have anything in their car, but dirty police officers planted something in their car.
It's very true. Happens more than people would imagine.
It does. When you consider things such as a crappy police stop, racial profiling. This didn't just happen today. No. This has been going on for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
And 2020 has exposed how racism is not as hidden as we think.
Right.
As a leader in the Nashville community and as a leader really across this country, you've seen various acts of racism. You've seen how families have been torn up based upon the egregious acts of others. Tell us a little bit about your firsthand experience with that.
Oh, man. You cannot be a leader in the African-American community and not touch trauma.
Yeah.
You cannot be a part of our community, our culture, and not be affected, touched by coming into contact with it. As a pastor in Nashville, I see it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I've had families in my church that have been impacted by it. I've seen the community in which I serve, Edge Hill, South Nashville.
Yeah.
See it all the time. See it on a regular basis. Folk come to me, come to us as faith leaders in the African-American community as advocates.
Yeah.
Because in many cases, they don't have the option of finding advocates. They get ignored.
Yeah.
They get thrown into a case pile. They get mismanaged and manipulated by attorneys or public defenders or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And so they come to us to kind of have a voice.
Right.
Someone who won't get ignored, someone who won't get pushed to the side. So I've seen it here. I've seen it everywhere I've been, where our communities have the lowest socioeconomic status.
Right.
Our communities are placed in places where access to regular resources and regular necessities are slim at best. Mm-hmm. We're in food deserts. We have places with little to no employment access or income. And so these spots and these spaces end up becoming breeding grounds for trauma incidents.
Yeah.
And trauma moments, contact with law enforcement or different other kinds of avenues where folks are trying to survive.
Right.
And end up being caught in a system that's really not designed to serve them.
Wow. When you think about all of that, this is intergenerational trauma.
Sure.
This is historic in that it is something that our great grandmama dealt with, our grandmama dealt with, our mama dealt with.
Yes.
And now it's a part of our generation.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot of the trauma that we're feeling has nothing to do with us inherently.
Sure.
It has everything to do with individuals that want to keep us confined and contained and want to keep us on a certain level as not to progress along the way.
Yeah.
So what do you say to those individuals who are dealing with this kind of intergenerational trauma that can't break out of it,
right,
that feel as if, well, I'm always going to live in the project,
right,
or I'm always going to be on welfare, or I'm always going to be in this condition. I just can't get ahead.
I would tell them two things. The first one is you're not alone.
Yeah.
There's not a person of color in this country that hasn't felt the heat and the intensity of oppression. There's not a person of color in this nation that has ever lived that did not feel that impact and that reach. I don't care where they lived. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're a bus driver or an NBA multi-million dollar player.
Yeah.
You get put in a scenario where all you're seeing is your skin color, your ethnicity, and you get treated a certain way.
Right.
So you're not alone. James Baldwin said that to be black in America is to live in a constant state of rage.
Yeah.
It's this idea of having to be angry all the time.
Right.
Right. He says you're American without privilege, but African without history.
Wow.
It's stuck in this in-betweenness,
yeah,
of proud of who you are, but at the same time being mismanaged, mistreated, and often ostracized and X'd out of society for who you are.
Right.
It is accumulated trauma. It comes from our parents felt it, our grandparents felt it, as you share. And what people have to understand is that's not accidental.
Right. Exactly.
That's intentional.
Oh, yeah.
The systems in which we operate and live in this country in particular were designed to make folks that look like us feel less than.
Oh, yeah.
It was designed to create an inferiority in our mindset and in our approach to life.
Right.
That we always come to the table needing more or feeling as if we are inadequate.
Right.
Slavery built that into us.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Crow built that into us.
Mm-hmm.
The presence of the KKK and oppression and intimidation built that into us. Matter of fact, the Constitution built that into us.
Yeah, let's be clear.
The Constitution told us we were 3/5 of a person.
Yeah.
So now there are folks who are trying to engage in a system that really was not designed for them in the first place.
Right.
And it creates this frustration.
Sure.
It creates this anxiety. It creates this almost fatalism, nihilism,
yeah,
that says, I can't escape, so why try?
Right.
I can't get out, so why try? The first thing I'd say is that I feel you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm with you. I got it. You are not by yourself.
Right.
But the second thing I would tell you is that you still have agency.
Yeah.
You still have the choice to improve and to progress. It is something I like to call resilience, mm-hmm. that we are, because of our trauma and because of our history, there is also something I believe. Now, this is me. I ain't got no Bible for this.
Yeah.
I don't have no psychology for this, but I just believe God has placed within folks who deal with depression the resilience to survive it and to overcome it.
Absolutely.
If I didn't believe that, I'd have quit long time.
Oh, yeah. Without question.
If others did not have it, they would have quit long time ago.
That's right.
But there are folks who have come face to face with the challenges and have overcome them because of the grit, the resiliency, and they decided to make some choices.
Yeah.
Now, you can't fix the world around you.
Right.
You can't change everything that's happening. Over time, if you fight, if you invest, if you get involved in justice work, over time, you can make it better for your children. But what you inherited, you cannot always change for yourself.
Right.
So at some point, I have to decide I will not be who they said I am.
That's right.
I will not become and bow down to this graven image of inferiority that I'm being pushed and coerced to bow down to.
Yeah.
I have more. I am more. And I refuse to settle for anything less than that.
Wow, man, that's an excellent point. You know, we have to change the narrative, even if it's our own internal narrative.
Yeah.
We can't acquiesce or say yes to what people are telling us that we are or how we should be or how we should live. To your point, we got to be resilient.
Sure.
You know, there's a condition called post-traumatic slave syndrome. You know, it's literally a condition that exists kind of as a consequence of centuries of chattel slavery, followed by institutionalized racism and oppression that have, you know, resulted in a multi-generational adaptive behavior. You know, some positive, reflecting resilience, like you mentioned, and others that are harmful and destructive. At the end of the day, we take on this stress, we take on this trauma, and we live in it. And it kind of, if you're not careful, either you're going to control it or it's going to control you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'll just talk personally, right? What we don't realize is the accumulation of trauma, how it shows up in our lives.
Yes.
Right. It shows up in the shortening and the diminishing of our dreams. Mm-hmm. But man, it shows up in our health.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. It shows up in the weight and the heaviness with which we carry. Right. COVID-19, 2020, life shuts down.
Yeah.
You know, as we know,
right.
Life shut down. But racism didn't shut down.
Oh, no. It turned up.
Yeah. So all of a sudden we run into the Ahmaud Arbery situation in Georgia.
That's right.
We run into the George Floyd situation in Minneapolis.
Yep.
We run into the Breonna Taylor situation in Louisville.
Yeah.
Right. Now, these are not new instances.
Oh, no.
These are not new happenings.
No.
These things have been happening since we got here.
Yeah.
Right. This is what it is. This is the kind of system that we have to navigate. So because this wasn't new, we've seen this before. People just kind of expected to move on and you know, we'd have the uprisings, we'd have the peak interest and response, but then we'd move on.
Right.
As we normally do.
Yeah.
Right. But COVID-19 wouldn't let us move on. We had nothing to move on to.
That's right.
We had no job to go back to.
Yeah.
There was no sports to go watch.
Yeah.
There was nothing routine and regular to take us away from it. And so, man, for the first time, at least in our generation,
yeah.
man, we had to sit with this.
Yeah, that's right.
And every day, all day, if it wasn't the news, it was social media.
Yeah.
If it wasn't social media, it was podcasts and radio. Everybody's talking about injustice, and we're looking at it, and we're seeing it. Then we had a resident of the White House.
Oh, yeah.
Can't call him a president.
Yeah.
He didn't fit the qualification. Yeah. A resident of the White House who would then reinforce the oppression and the trauma and use the seal of the United States government to sanction it.
Absolutely. That's right.
Man, listen, let me tell you something. There were days where I could feel the heaviness in my body.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a pretty healthy guy, but I could feel the tension.
Yeah.
I could feel the anxiety. It was palatable, man. It was so real, I could almost touch it.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to go out and walk. I had to take laps. I had to get that stuff out of me.
Yeah.
I had to do some exercise to get that stress off of me,
right.
man, because I knew what it was. It's accumulated trauma.
That's right.
It's constantly hearing that, man, you're a threat. It's constantly hearing and seeing that people who look like you can die with impunity.
That's right.
And there'd be no repercussions. There'd be no consequences.
That's right.
It's the trauma, man, of seeing my kids now have to get behind the wheel. And I'm wondering if they're going to get home.
Oh, yeah.
It's that reinforced, cyclical, accumulated trauma. Man, that thing will sit on you.
Yes, it will.
And I'm not sure we have the research. I'm not sure we have the data. You're referencing a book by Dr. Joy DeGruy. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure we have the data of trauma's impact on African-American health.
Right.
It's got to exist somewhere.
Right.
But man, I promise you, there's a direct correlation. We always talk about psychological and emotional. But man, there are physical impacts to this.
That's right.
We feel that weight.
Yeah.
We feel that tension. And it leads to hypertension. It leads to eating disorders. It leads to sleep apnea and insomnia. Man, I ain't slept, dude. I ain't slept good.
Yeah.
I ain't slept good since about April, man.
I agree.
You know, I got my cycles are off.
Yeah.
My stuff, you know, I need some circadian rhythms and stuff. I'm just off, but I know what it is.
Yeah.
It's the trauma.
Yeah, it is.
It's the trauma, man. So it lives in us, and we got to find ways to process it.
Yeah, man, we do. We have to find ways to process it. And the fact is, there's so many people living a trauma-led life.
Yeah.
Their behavior is based upon trauma. Their decisions are based upon trauma.
Sure.
And the various challenges within their health is based upon trauma.
Yeah.
And to be honest, most of it is embedded trauma. Trauma that has been passed through the bloodline from one generation to the next. And listen, I know we'll get there, but that's why it's so important for people to intentionally deal with the trauma so that the trauma won't deal with them.
Sure.
Let me say it differently. It's vitally important to strategically and methodically work to take out the trauma so that the trauma won't take them out. Man, listen, when we consider the various traumas that we as African Americans have experienced, God has always raised up leaders.
Yeah.
I mean, these leaders that he's raised up, they have helped to provide strategy, direction, and even energize the people.
Yeah.
You know, during the 1800s, there was Harriet Tubman who went against the grain to lead blacks to freedom.
Sure.
In 1905, there was Robert Abbott, who was the founder of the Chicago Defender, which was a black newspaper that literally helped spread the message of equality and justice.
Yeah.
Of course, we all know about Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Rosa Parks, but there were other leaders, college students such as John Lewis and individuals such as C.T. Vivian, who went against the status quo to provide an opportunity for freedom and equality for their race.
Yeah.
Then you got lesser known leaders such as Ella Baker, who ran voter registration drives and organized various protests.
Sure.
Man, what would you say to those who dare ask, where are today's leaders? What would you say to those who question if the leaders are here? What would you say?
Man, I'll tell you, they're here. They're absolutely here.
Yeah.
They are serving, they are working. And you have to remember now, when John Lewis was doing what he was doing, he was about 23.
Exactly.
When he was the youngest platform speaker at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. Prior to that, he was a student at American Baptist College and student at Fisk.
Yeah.
Man, he was 20.
Yeah.
During 1960, when they integrated downtown, the Lux Shop in Nashville.
Yeah.
So he's 20 years old.
Absolutely.
Yeah. At this time, right?
Yeah.
You're looking for the leaders today, look for folks in their 20s who are serving.
Yeah.
It's not the people with titles necessarily today.
It's
the college students.
That's right.
It's the young folk who are providing the energy and the momentum for these movements. It's the Black Lives Matter folk.
Yeah.
People can say what they want to say about them, but they get it done. Now, in every city, they bring awareness and attention, and you cannot ignore it.
That's right.
Period. Yeah. You've been trying to ignore it since 2014 when it was birthed in Ferguson.
Yeah.
But they're still here.
Yeah.
And the reason they're still here is because they adopted their mode of leadership.
Yeah.
America is not kind to black leadership.
Not at all.
Let's be very clear. Every leader that has risen to power and become a vocal influence in America, America shoots them.
Yeah, literally.
Literally. America assassinates black leadership.
Yeah.
You talk about Fred Hampton. You talk about Martin Luther King. Everybody wants to talk about Martin Luther King. You need to be like Martin King. They shot him.
Yeah, they did.
He was assassinated.
That's
Malcolm
right.
X, I mean, we can go on and on. Any African-American leader gets attacked, gets assassinated, gets disenfranchised, gets isolated because that was the mold and the model of leadership in previous generations. That was the one we used. But when the assassinations occurred, you cut the leader off, and then the people begin to scatter. Well, yeah. Newer generations of leaders understood this, and they see this. So yeah. The Black Lives Matter movement, you can't find a president of Black Lives Matter.
Right, right.
You can't find, they're located in different cities, but you can't find a leader, one established person that speaks for everybody, because their model of leadership is collaborative.
Yeah.
Why is that? You don't know who to shoot.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't know what head. You don't know what a head is. You don't know what leader to take out. So their mode is adaptive, and they can grow and flourish and still impact, because those who would attempt to stop the movement don't know who to aim at.
Yeah.
They learn from previous generations. So the leaders are here.
Yeah.
They're just covert. They're clandestine.
They're
leaders. They're absolutely doing the work. They're in the streets.
Yeah.
And they're doing things from feeding hungry folks. They're doing things for offering breakfast and after school programs for kids. They're doing work like making sure that low income families get access to education and can get connected through the digital divide while they're under this quarantine and COVID situation. They are providing home ownership skills and training and teaching and financial literacy in the hood. They're providing they're doing the work, but we haven't dubbed them as leaders because there's not one personality that rises to the occasion, because that's not their model, but they're doing the work.
Yeah. When you consider the trauma of even being an African-American leader, you know, one who is doing the work, you know, you're not just talking about it, you're doing the work in the community, and you consider working with individuals who don't look like you, who don't necessarily want to hear from you, but they have no choice but to come to you because you represent a large population in a city that welcomed you by pulling you over and attempting to harass you. How do you work with these individuals knowing the stress that sometimes you have to deal with in doing so?
Man, that's a whole dissertation. That's a book series.
Yeah,
man. I'm always going to be led by, and I'm always going to evaluate my responses based on people's actions.
Right.
Right. So I'm not going to ever prejudge and make an assumption on someone because they look different from me that they believe and operate a certain way. Mm-hmm. That would be perpetuating the same thing that is being done to me.
That's right.
So I give everybody a shot.
Yeah.
Give everybody a chance.
Yeah.
Man, I'm telling you, if you just let people talk, they'll tell you what they're about, what they're into. And then you just watch what they do. You just sit back in the cut and chill and pay attention.
Yeah.
And man, people show you who they are.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
Just, you know, time. Yeah. Just sit back, be patient, and jokers will show you what they're about, who they are, and what their motives are. So I don't make assumptions. I just try to chill and watch.
Yeah.
And based upon that, then I respond. I also I've had to do this more this year. I'll be honest, man. I've had to become very, very intentional about boundaries and limits of where I'm going to give my time and where I'm going to give my energy. When this thing jumped off, I mean, it really got hot, June, July, August.
Yeah.
Man, I got so many calls from some of my white brothers and sisters and emails and let's sit down, let's do a Zoom, let's talk. You know, we weren't going to lunch there. Let's do a Zoom, let's have a phone call, let's do this, that. Man, when I tell you, I was so tired.
Yeah.
I was so tired. I appreciated the awakening that was happening, and I knew why it was happening.
Yeah.
But man, I got to a point where I just decided, I'm not doing your work for you.
Exactly.
Like I'll be the guy that helps sharpen your lens.
Yeah.
But man, I'm not going to do the work for you. If this is something you want to pursue, you got to do this work. I got a reading list for you.
Yeah.
I got some books that I recommend, but I'm not going to sit here every day and relive trauma trying to explain to you what's easily accessible if you just simply paid attention.
If you just watch,
look around. This is not hard.
Yeah.
This is not difficult, but I'm supposed to be the interpreter for all Black people of how we feel, right? It's like, bro, I'm done with that. I'm not doing it.
Right.
I'm not doing it. After you do this reading and check out this podcast and look at this, then we'll sit down and talk.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not going to be your lexicon and your tour guide through oppression.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just not doing it. I'm not. I can't give my energy to that. I told you, I'm dealing with trauma and heaviness myself.
That's right.
And so I have to learn how to pull back.
Well, that's all the time we have for episode number 14. Join us next week for part two as we continue the trauma associated with the African-American experience with Dr. John R. Faison. Until next time, peace.
Thanks for listening to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Follow us on social media at Necessary Conversations Podcast. Join the conversation by leaving a message on our website, necessaryconversationspodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll be notified every time a new one drops. Now, go have the conversations you need to have with the people you need to have them with.